I think we have this idea that when it comes down to spiritual knowledge or knowledge about consciousness and things like that, that, you know, that speakers should be saying something new. I was at a conference in Findhorn a while back, and somebody stood up and said, at the end of my talk, he said, it was a German actually, he said, "What is it you're saying that is new? What do you know? What is it you're saying that is different from what other people are saying?" And my response was, "Hopefully nothing." Because, you know, if I'm differing, then that's where I'm off track. Because if we're talking, I mean, this session's called the perennial philosophy or something like that. And that means the eternal wisdom, the eternal knowledge, which comes up again and again and again in different cultures. And that means it's the same, it's that eternal wisdom. And that doesn't change. Maybe the expressions of it change, the cultures in which it's expressed change, but the actual wisdom doesn't change. So I think what's happening today is, as we are rediscovering that wisdom for ourselves, we are learning to express it in 20th century terms, perhaps scientific terms, soon 21st century terms. But it's nothing new. It's not like physics or computer sciences where you expect someone to stand up and give you something new. And my own journey in this really began when I was doing physics. I started off, as you heard in the introduction, I was a mathematician, physicist. That's when I was studying with Stephen Hawking. And there came a point where, after about 3 years, I realized that this was never going to answer the questions I was really interested in. I mean, I'd reached the point in my sort of physics undergraduate degree where I could, you know, solve Schrödinger's equation for a hydrogen atom, which is, you know, a very nice intellectual achievement of Western science, that you can begin to, from pure mathematics, basically start predicting the element hydrogen, and you, from that you can just begin to get a sense of some of its intrinsic chemical properties and things, how it will interact with other hydrogen atoms. But the really interesting question for me was, how is it that hydrogen, the most basic element, could evolve into this universe, including beings like myself, because we've all evolved out of that primal stuff? How is it that hydrogen evolved into a being like myself that could step back and study the wave equation of hydrogen? How had hydrogen come to understand itself? Which is basically, how had the universe become aware? Where had consciousness come from? And that took me, I left physics, I moved into psychology and took another degree in experimental psychology. And after doing that, I realized I knew nothing more about consciousness. I knew a lot more about the brain and perception and memory and nothing about rats, because I decided to miss that whole part of the curriculum. I realized, I looked at the curriculum and realized I could go to no rat lectures whatsoever. And all that did was just made my choice in the final exam. Instead of having to choose 6 questions out of 8, I had to choose 6 out of 6. So that was my choice, and I missed the rats. And at the end of that time, I realized, as I say, I still knew nothing more about consciousness. And so I went to India. I was interested in meditation and was studying meditation and Eastern philosophy. And I think 2 things happened when I was there in India. The first was realizing that there was something to spirituality after all. Earlier, I'd given up religion. When I was about 13, I was brought up regular Protestant Church of England, and which meant, you know, you go to church once a month and that's probably enough to deal with your sins, hopefully. And about age 13, I went through the normal process of confirmation. And all this stuff I was meant to believe, I just looked at it and decided it was all, as far as I was concerned, unbelievable. You know, God creating the world in 6 days and virgin birth and all this stuff. I just thought, science, if it's a choice between science and something which is, you know, a lot of statements from a few thousand years ago, I prefer science. And so I announced that I was done with religion at age 13 and followed my scientific path. And it was, whatever it was, more than 10 years later when I was in India, that I realized perhaps there was something to religion, to spirituality after all, and that there was a common wisdom there. And a lot of my life since then has been following that. What is that wisdom? Following it for myself and also trying to bring that out to the world today in contemporary terms. Because the second thing I realized when I was there in India was that it was the fact that this wisdom was missing was why we had so many problems in the world today. That because the spiritual aridity of our culture was why so many things were going wrong. Was any problem, if you trace it back to its source, it comes back to human thinking, human values, human consciousness. And it struck me that we're very good at solving the external problems, but we don't really look at what are the inner problems that are causing it. You know, so we see an environmental problem and we immediately go and start saying, well, you know, okay, we must stop putting CFCs into the atmosphere because they're destroying the ozone layer. And yes, we need to do that, but we're not also looking at what is it in our thinking that leads us to do these things in the first place. Because if we don't deal with that, then the problem's not really going to go away. It may manifest in another form. Well, it's interesting to take CFCs because, you know, since the Montreal Agreement, which was what, 91, 92, was it? I can't remember, but whatever it is, it's, you know, more than 5 years ago now, maybe nearly 10. We're still pumping CFCs into the atmosphere. We're still producing them. When I say we, I don't mean the United States or England, but they're still being produced in Mexico. They're still being produced in Eastern Europe because those countries economically can't just stop producing them. So for economic reasons, we're still allowing those countries to produce them. And I don't know whether you know, but the second greatest import into this country, illegal import after drugs, is chlorofluorocarbons coming in from Eastern Europe and from Mexico to refill people's air conditioners in their cars. So it hasn't stopped the problem because we haven't changed our consciousness. So that's what I realized was that if we're really going to solve problems in the world today, it's about how do we change our consciousness. And so I came back from India realizing that what I really wanted to do was to devote my life to this area in one way or another, which is what I have been doing. And to me, this is spiritual work, although I don't often talk in spiritual terms. I will today here. A lot of the work I do in corporations, I'm trying to take these ideas and put them into very ordinary, everyday language that no one would suspect is anything to do with spirituality. So I think that's the way it should be. It's about putting these ideas in the language of the times. And it's about talking the sorts of things that Paul was talking about this morning, about how we perceive things, about our concepts, about our belief systems. But I'd like to go back to the root meaning of the word spiritual. It comes from the Latin spiritus, which means air, vapor, breath, wind, that sort of thing. And if we think about what is it that's common to those words? And to me, what is common about that idea of air, wind, breath, whatever you want to put it, is it's intangible. It's not material. You can't see the wind. You can't hold it. You can't measure it. And that's what consciousness is. Consciousness is that aspect of the world that we cannot see, measure, pin down. What science has done is take the aspect of the universe that we can measure and pin down, the world of matter, the world of space, time, and matter. And it's got very good at measuring that, finding out the laws of space, time, and matter, how it operates, and from that developing various technologies. I think what the spiritual traditions have done is explore the inner world, the world of consciousness, and from that develop their own laws and their own technologies to deliver us greater freedom, greater quality of life, but from working on the inside. So when I think of the spiritual, I don't necessarily mean anything to do with religion. It's just that a lot of religions is where that wisdom has become crystallized, sometimes fossilized as well. But it's basically, the spiritual work is basically about understanding the human mind. And from that, I say, come various laws and conclusions, which we then put into practice in our lives. So that's what the spiritual is. And I should maybe define also how I use the word consciousness, because consciousness is used in so many different ways in our culture. I kind of think it's a bit like the Eskimos with their 20 words for snow. You know, because Eskimos, because they have so many different, they're so much more aware of snow, because it's so much part of their life. They have all these different words for wind-blown snow and, you know, soft snow and wet snow and snow suitable for building igloos out of and that sort of thing. Well, like the rice, so the Chinese have 20 words for rice, I'm told, as well, for, you know, whether it's rice that's ready for cooking or rice that's cooked, whatever. It's the same with consciousness. If you go to, you know, look in Eastern philosophy, you find lots of different words for consciousness, for different aspects of consciousness. And we just use the one word, consciousness, sometimes interchangeably with awareness, sometimes with mind and other things. We don't really define it. It's that sort of general area of the interior world sort of thing. So the way I use consciousness, the way I'll be talking about consciousness here, is what I define as the faculty of consciousness. The fact that we are awake inside, that we have an interior world of experience. I'm not talking about any particular mode of consciousness, any particular state of consciousness, or any particular, you know, way of thinking, or whether we're awake or asleep, or anything like that. It's interesting, they're all states of consciousness, or modes of consciousness. They're all of consciousness. And I'm talking about the consciousness itself, which is just that faculty of interior experience, which, interestingly enough, is the one thing we cannot deny. It's the one thing we know for absolute certainty, is that we are all conscious beings. And that's what Descartes was really getting at with his cogito ergo sum. It's often, I think, misunderstood that. I mean, literally translated, it means, I think, therefore I am. And people often put Descartes down because they think he was saying that because I think, therefore my thinking gives me existence. But he wasn't saying that at all. What Descartes was doing, he was looking for truth, like many philosophers. And he was saying, what is the absolute truth? And he invented what he called his method of doubt. He said, whatever is absolutely true cannot be doubted. And so he sat down one evening to decide, was there anything he could not doubt? And he started realizing he could doubt what he was thinking, he could doubt what people told him, he could doubt various philosophies, he could even doubt his own experience. And he realized he could even doubt he had a body. That could just be an illusion. And then he realized what he could not doubt was that he was doubting. What was obvious, you know, he could doubt the contents of his experience, but he couldn't doubt the fact that there was experience. And because he was thinking, although all his thoughts may be wrong, the very fact he was thinking proved that the one thing that was absolutely true was he existed. That there was consciousness. There was interior experience. And yet, on the one hand, it's the most familiar thing to all of us. I mean, it's the only thing, in a way, we ever know, is our own experience. And Paul mentioned Immanuel Kant earlier. I mean, one of the things Kant showed is that we never, ever directly know the external reality, whatever that is. All we ever know is that reconstruction which happens in our own minds. You know, right now you are seeing the room, information is coming in through your eyes, it's going to the back of the brain, where it's processed, analyzed, and the brain very cleverly pieces it all together again, and then integrates it with sound and your sensation of sitting in a chair, and then reconstructs for you this incredibly coherent, three-dimensional, colourful experience of being in a room. But that's a reconstruction in your own mind. So in a strange way, everything you're experiencing is constructed out of consciousness, or in India they say constructed out of mind stuff. So in that sense, consciousness in a way is absolutely fundamental to everything we know. And it's all we ever know. And yet, as far as Western science is concerned, consciousness is one great, big, huge problem. There is nothing, absolutely nothing, in Western science that predicts that any living creature, human beings or rats, any living creature, should have an interior world of experience. Science would work perfectly well if we were all biological robots. and if it was all dark inside. There's nothing in science to suggest that we should be aware. So, in Kuhnian terms, Thomas Kuhn, who came up with the idea of paradigm, coined the word paradigm when it was 30, 40 years ago. The paradigm, I'm sure you all know what a paradigm is. A paradigm is that basic, the underlying worldview that underlies a particular science. And what Kuhn showed was those worldviews change with time. So, you know, Plato's ideas of motion got replaced by Newton's ideas of motion, and they got replaced by Einstein's ideas of motion. Paradigms change over time. And what Kuhn showed is that it usually happens because there's some anomaly. There's something that doesn't fit the old worldview. The classic case is probably the Copernican Revolution, where the anomaly was the planets moving unevenly through the sky. All the stars seemed to go around the Earth in nice smooth circles, but the planets sort of went backwards and forwards and accelerated. In fact, the Greek word planet means to wander. They were the stars that wandered. And nobody could explain that easily, because everybody thought things had to move in circles, because Plato had said the perfect motion is circular motion, and heavenly bodies being perfect must move in circles. And so everybody was creating all these circles, rolling around circles in the sky to try and account for the planets. And they called these epicycles, or these circles rolling around circles. And along came Copernicus and said, supposing the Earth moves, supposing the Earth's actually spinning round, what then? And out of that came the whole Copernican Revolution. But the anomaly was the planets that triggered the whole thing. I think consciousness is one huge, big anomaly for the current scientific worldview. It's an anomaly because it's absolutely obvious. None of us can deny that there is consciousness in the universe. The act of denying it is absolute proof there is consciousness in the universe. And there is absolutely nothing in the current scientific worldview to account for it. That's an anomaly. And what happens when there's an anomaly? Well, what Kuhn showed is the first stage is people ignore it. And science has done that. It's got through its stage of ignoring consciousness. You know, we can't study it, we can't pin it down, and anyway, the universe works perfectly well without it, so we don't have to worry about it too much. Then you move into the second stage, where you realize you can't ignore it, so you have to start trying to include it within the current model. That's what happened when the early astronomers started making epicycles of things rolling around circles and rolling around circles. Which is, I think, what we're doing at the moment. What most of science is doing at the moment with consciousness, whether it's trying to explain it in terms of something that comes out of quantum physics, or whether it's something that comes out of neuropeptides in the brain, or something that comes out of chaos theory in terms of the complexity of the interaction of the information in the brain. It's all trying to explain consciousness on the assumption that space, time, and matter are real, and that consciousness somehow comes out of it. Whereas if you look at what a lot of the ancient teachings say, and a lot of also modern teachings as well, they say that consciousness is fundamental. That's the other paradigm, that consciousness is an absolutely fundamental part of existence. That goes dead against the current scientific worldview, is that space-time matter is fundamental and consciousness comes out of it. But I think that the new model we are moving towards is one that in some way or another, and we haven't got there yet, but in some way or another has consciousness as an absolutely fundamental aspect of the universe. And that, I think, is what, if that ties in with the perennial philosophy, that's what all the teachings have said all along, well, most of them. And we have to find out how that then matches and integrates what we now know in science. And my own explorations of this suggest that when you do that, when you make consciousness fundamental, nothing much in physics changes. Nothing much in any of the sciences changes, which is quite normal when you have this sort of paradigm shift. The old laws still apply, but something new happens as well. There's something new is added. And what I think happens is when you make consciousness as fundamental as space, time, and matter, in some ways it becomes more fundamental than space, time, and matter, then you start seeing a way that science can begin to understand spirituality. at the moment, you know, science and spirit seem to be at loggerheads. Most scientists feel that spirituality, as it's commonly understood, is nothing to do with science. I mean, some scientists feel they very proudly now, at the end of the 20th century, we've got rid of God completely. And Paul Davis said in one of his books, Paul Davis is a sort of physicist, cosmologist, he said, science has looked out to the edges of the universe, what he called deep space, and we've looked down, back in time to the beginning of the universe, what he called deep time, to the Big Bang or whatever was there, probably wasn't a bang, but whatever happened back at the beginning of the universe, and we've looked down through matter, to what he calls deep structure, down to the quantum level, quarks, that level. So it looked out into deep space, deep time, deep matter, the three dimensions of the current scientific worldview, and said we have found no place for God and no need for God. QED. But what all the great mystics have said is, it's not out there in the world of space, time and matter, it's in your own experience. And science hasn't even begun to really explore consciousness, let alone get to the stage where we can say we've looked into deep mind, and we now know the very limits of mind. We've hardly begun. But I think when we do, when we really begin to look into consciousness and really discover the depths of the mind, we're going to start finding the same truths that the mystics, the saints, the sages, through all the years have been expressing. But maybe we're going to start expressing to ourselves in ways that fit in with the current with current science, with the 20th century, rather than necessarily in religious terms. So I think when science starts opening to consciousness, it's actually unwittingly embarking on this journey that's going to lead it to the one subject it has so strenuously avoided for hundreds of years. It's going to start finding itself having to open up and really understand what spirituality is all about. And if you look at those teachings, what they say is when you really begin to understand the nature of consciousness, you begin to understand the nature of self. Paul was talking earlier about the ego, that limited sense of self. Most of the time, we create an artificial sense of self for us. We have this feeling of I-ness, which I would suggest is just the feeling, ultimately, the feeling of consciousness. Perhaps even feeling isn't the right word. We have this sense of I-ness. It's partly because we always find ourselves at the center of this world we've created around ourselves. I mean, right now, I imagine each of you are experiencing yourself at the center of your world, this world you've created in your mind. Occasionally we don't. I mean, occasionally you might find yourself up in the corner of the room looking down and outside your body. We call that an out-of-the-body experience. Actually, I think we're always having an out-of-the-body experience. Just sometimes the center of that is in the brain, and we call that an in-body experience, and that's the normal type of experience. So we give ourselves this sense of self that's somehow located at the center of our universe, our personal universe. And because we don't know the deep mind, the deeper levels of consciousness, we start taking on other qualities. We like to define ourselves. And so we start defining ourselves in terms of, you know, our body that we seem to be living within, and our personalities that we seem to live through, and what we do and what we have, and then all that stuff. And so we start defining this sense of identity, which is derived ultimately from our experience of the world. But that is because that's very, very vulnerable, and as soon as the world changes in some unexpected way, our identity is shaken, threatened. We end up having to continually do things to reaffirm our sense of self, our sense of who we are. I think all of us can see in ourselves and other people how much human energy is spent just trying to reaffirm this artificially derived sense of self. And if you look at what most of the spiritual teachings say, they say that as you begin to explore the nature of consciousness, you realize that is an illusion. It's something you've created. You know, something like in Buddhism, they actually say that there is no such self. Others talk about it as an illusion that it is there, but you have to transcend it. Whatever. I think ultimately they're all pointing towards the same thing. In Indian philosophy, they talk about that level of the self as ahamkara. That's the self, sometimes called the arrogating self. Not meaning that you're so much arrogant, but that is the self that has taken everything onto it, that's described itself in all these forms. And go deeper into the mind, usually through meditation or other practices, that begins to drop away, and you come to a level often called jiva in Indian philosophy, which is that sense of I-ness, the individual spark of consciousness, before it is identified with all these things, which we aren't really anyway. And then deeper than that is Atman, which you might just translate as pure consciousness without any sense of individuality. And then ultimately Brahman, which is probably best translated as the whole or all that is. And what the mystics say, the great saints, sages, when you get down to those levels, the ultimate realization is that Atman is Brahman, which is best translated in Western language as I am God, which gets people into a lot of trouble. I mean, the Sufi mystic Al-Halaj was burnt at the stake for saying I am God, and Meister Eckhart in Germany several hundred years ago was hauled up before the Inquisition for saying I am God, and he was forced to modify his sermons. He was allowed to say, I've had an experience of unity with God, but he wasn't allowed to have any statement of identity with God, because that went right against the church. And it's also, I mean, crazy in our culture as well. People get put in mental asylums for saying it. And it was Ram Dass who said once that he was visiting his brother who was in a mental asylum, and his brother said, how is it that you can go around the world saying, I am God, and everybody buys your books and listens to you, and I say it and they put me inside a mental asylum? And he said, well, the difference is that when I say it, I say everybody else's as well. And everything else is as well. Every sentient being in the universe is. But I think that is the deepest truth that I think all the teachings are pointing towards, is that consciousness is God. For me, it's almost a triple identity. If it's the word I in its finest sense, when we really get down to the depths of what we mean by I, and when we really get to the depths of what we mean by consciousness, then we find there's an identity of those two with each other and with, I think, what we mean by God. Which is why so many mystics, people when they've experienced these states of consciousness, want to put it in spiritual terms. I mean, some use the word God, others use other words. I tend to use the word God for this merely because that was my own upbringing. That was the culture I was brought up in. That was the label I had for it. And it still fits for me. That label fits perfectly. And what I'm fascinated by at the moment is how you can take many classical descriptions of God, traditional descriptions of God, and when you start applying them to the essence of consciousness, that faculty of consciousness, before it takes on any form in the mind, before it becomes this world we are all experiencing for ourselves, it equates perfectly with so many statements about God. I mean, just give you a few that are important for me. First of all, you know, the peace of God, peace. most, well, I think just every teaching brings out the fact that when you reach those levels of consciousness, when the mind becomes completely still, what is often called samadhi, which means in Sanskrit, still mind, when the mind becomes still, it isn't just stillness, it isn't just the mind stopped thinking and experience of things has stopped. It's an experience of incredible peace. Or sometimes it's maybe expressed as bliss or ecstasy, which probably aren't quite the right words in our culture because they tend to invoke ideas of, you know, ecstasy we think is like, you know, having a wonderful sexual experience or something. We get so caught up in that dimension. It literally, the original meaning of ecstasy is to stand outside of oneself. That's what it means, ecstasis, to stand outside of one's normal self. So it's a state of bliss, it's a state of peace. God the Creator, I mean, everything we experience is created out of mind stuff, out of consciousness. God is love, what Paul was talking about earlier. And also Hugh, I think, as well. When you get down to those levels, you find that at that level of consciousness, there is spontaneously love. Not in the romantic sense, but in compassion, caring. Because the mind is no longer hooked up on all that ego stuff, that false illusion of who you are that keeps you looking after yourself the whole time. So as soon as you transcend that egocentricity, you start getting down, you start discovering those, the love that's there anyway. And trust is important for me. We're talking about trusting in God. For me, that's about trusting in my own inner wisdom that is there as my essence. I feel that, I think we all have the truth within us. It's just we get so caught up on our various superficial levels of thinking, we don't really access it. Or sometimes people do access it, they can't believe they have that wisdom within them, and so they create some sub-personality of some deva from some other culture who is, quote, channeling through them. I think most of that stuff is actually people just contacting the wisdom that they have deep within themselves and not quite knowing what to do with it and not believing that I could have this wisdom in myself and therefore creating some nice sub-personality to express it for them. See, and this is, I think, the key thing Paul was saying earlier, which I think is so important. In every moment of every day, we have a choice about how we see things. And one way of expressing that is we can either see it through the eyes of the ego and all that stuff, through the self-centeredness, through that neediness to continually reaffirm who we are, or we can see it through the eyes of whatever you want to call it, the pure self, the eyes of God, whatever. We have a choice. Now, most of the time, we forget that. Well, I know I do. 99.9% of the time, I forget I have that choice. Part of the practice for me is finding ways to remember I have that choice, that in every moment I can choose how I see things. Do I see it out of the eyes of the ego, which is basically the eyes of fear? Because the ego mind wants to be in control of things. And that's, I think that's part of the conditioning of consciousness that's happened in our culture. We've been conditioned into a control mode of working. Because we've been taught, more or less from the moment we're born, that if you want to be happy, if you want to be at peace, you need to be in control of your world, of your personal universe. And if you're in control of your universe, then you can have the things you think you need to make you happy, or the experiences you need, whatever it is, the opportunities. Because our culture tells us, if you're going to be at peace, if you're going to be happy, you need to have the world be the right way, that our inner well-being depends upon what happens around us. And so we're continually looking to see if the world is the right way. And that's where so much of our fear comes from. That if we think we've got to have the world be a particular way for us to be happy, then we start thinking about what's going to happen in 10 minutes' time or 10 days' time, you know, what will happen to me here in the next 10 minutes, or what's going to happen to the stock market in 10 days' time, or my relationship next year, or whatever. We start thinking about the future, which first of all goes against most teachings who say it's about being here now in the present moment. As soon as we start thinking about the future, then by definition, we're not in the present moment. But worse than that, if we start thinking about the future, we start thinking, am I going to be in control of my world in the future? Is it going to be the way I think it should be? And usually the mind finds all these possibilities of how it may not be the way I think it should be. And we start fearing all these things that might happen. Often think fear stands for future expectations assumed real. All these things we think might happen, but we don't know whether they will or not. And almost by definition, a mind that is fearful, a mind that is worrying about things, by definition cannot be a mind that is at peace. And I sort of think this is the sort of the sad joke about human beings. Every one of us wants to be at peace. I think that is the fundamental motivation of consciousness, to be at peace in itself. And yet we're so busy worrying whether or not we're going to be at peace in the future, we never have the opportunity to be at peace in the present moment. So we're just, you know, who was it said this morning? We are our own worst enemies. We're actually stopping ourselves being there. And that's because of this, the mind talking to itself, the language function. And that's something the ego does. It gets very caught up in the wordage, the thinking, the self-talk. So trust for me is trusting that below all this dialogue that goes on in my mind that is usually fear-driven, when I reckon when I watch myself, I could probably do quite easily without 90% of my thoughts. I'd probably be much better off without them, because they're mostly fear-driven and just taking up my attention, stopping me actually experiencing what is. And you look at most techniques of meditation, in one way or another, they're about stilling the mind, switching off that discursive voice, that self-talk that chatters away to you all the time about what if this, what should I do this, and should I make a phone call later, da-da-da-da-da-da. All that internal chatter. Trusting that underneath that, there is that wisdom that can shine through. That's a long way of saying what I mean by God is trust, or trusting in God. It's trusting in the wisdom that is there within all of us that gets covered up by all this discursive activity that goes on. And I think we can actually take that exploration of consciousness, we can actually be scientific about that. Because although science has focused on the world of space, time and matter, that which can be measured and pinned down, etc., I think the process can be just as well applied to our own exploration of consciousness. And the process, you can put it in various ways, but just very simply is, you know, one has an idea, a hypothesis, you play around with it, you test it out. In regular science, you do some formal experiment, probably. But you test out the idea, you see what happens, you check it out with other people, see if they get similar results. We can do that with consciousness. We can start saying, you know, what happens if we just sit quietly and begin to watch what happens in the mind? You know, turn our attention just to that arising of the thoughts, and just begin to separate, you know, what are verbal thoughts, what are images, what are body feelings. Like, turn the microscope onto the mind, start becoming aware of things. You could start forming hypotheses about what would happen if you did that. Then you could experiment, you could try that out. You could sit down, begin to observe the mind, or maybe do some other practice which quietens the mind. You may learn things. You can check those out with other people. Go and read books what other people have done when they practice these sorts of meditation, see what happens, see if you get the same results. You can do that. So we can actually be scientific in the spiritual work. Like the spiritual work is the exploration of consciousness. So we can be scientific in that work. And for me, the ultimate hypothesis, which I think is what I'll leave you with today, is something which I'm playing with in my life myself, is, and it takes a lot of practice, it's not easy, all these things are not that easy, but take the hypothesis that what the mystics say is true, that I am God, not that I'm experiencing that the whole time at all, far from it, but take the hypothesis that that is true, that deepest level of consciousness, the faculty of consciousness that every sentient being in the universe has, that that is God, and then the experiment is to live your life as if that were true and to see what happens. So let's leave it there. I think we're on time.